Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, where we work together to connect the dots between politics and finance, a need for better education, humanity and world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and desire for equality of opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates who prioritize education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, and most of all, embracing creativity and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Please welcome my guest today, the incomparable film and television whirlwind from California to Virginia, Erica Arvold. I should mention the Arvold Company has enriched our world through television and film, whether casting, producing, or educating, and Erica was, among other things, the Virginia casting director for Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. Welcome, Erica. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Well, it's just,
wow.
As we were saying to each other before we went on air, it's been quite a while, but Erica and I go back quite a ways, actually. But let's talk about Erica. First of all, what initially brought you to the Mid-Atlantic states, particularly Charlottesville and in Central Virginia?
Well, it's full circle for me because I actually grew up and spent my most of my life and education in Blacksburg, Virginia, where I went to, grade school, middle school, and high school, and then moved on to Chicago, and then moved on to Los Angeles, and then when I met my husband, he came back to take over his father's company, and our child, and I came with Ted back to Charlottesville.
And there you go. So
it's been wonderful. I didn't think I'd be working. Yeah, I thought I left it all behind in California, and little did I.
Oh yes, surprise, surprise. Which begs the question, I guess. How did the Arvold Company get started, and just as importantly, why did it?
Well, it did because of incredibly selfish reasons. Mm. In that, if I was unable to talk film, if I was speaking in terms like station 12 or depth of field and things like that, people didn't understand me, I was lost. I mean, it was really, to me, the art of filmmaking is equivalent to bread and water, the way that I operate. And I loved not having it for about 5 years when my son was growing up and I was a full-time mom when I first moved here, and it was absolutely blissful. And then when he started school, I just got so itchy for that collaboration and that film talk, if you will, that I became quite involved. The Virginia Film Office was kind enough to welcome me here with open arms because I had, a pretty large handful of years of casting in Los Angeles.
Sure.
And so they were really welcoming and excited to have me here. And from that, I started getting quite involved with a nonprofit called the Virginia Production Alliance. And that's where you and I met, Mark.
Yeah. Yes.
And then that, essentially grew into so many people saying, well, can you cast for me? And I said, sure, but I don't know any local actors. All I know are Hollywood names.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, that's okay.
Yeah. Let's get some of them.
We also were like, well, have you seen this theater show? And what do you think of this actor? And so I started getting incredibly involved in just going to theater and you get an introduction to any actor possible. And I realized very quickly that the talent and the quality of talent here is no different than it is in New York and Los Angeles.
True.
There may not be as many opportunities to do film after film or television show after television show here, But in terms of the raw quality of an actor who does stage plays and understands the art of being vulnerable, that there's no difference. And so it got me really, really excited. And I started talking to my pals in Los Angeles saying, there's talent here in Virginia.
Yes.
And I want to do something about it. And that just it very organically grew, frankly, into what it is today.
Fantastic. And it just keeps growing the more I hear about it. It's expanding and it just leaps and bounds. There's no stopping. Well, I'm not surprised. I know you, so I know there's no stopping you. But I had the same experience. You know, I lived for years and worked in New York. And when I came here, I thought, well, gee, what am I going to do? And yet I have found, as you have, there's a huge number of talented actors around who are just, you know, wanting to work. And it's just a huge pool, great friends, great talent, and always inspiring even new work, which is always a favorite of mine,
too. Well, it is, and that's, for me, what really segued into producing was once I saw the talent here, it wasn't just actors, it was also filmmakers,
yes,
and photography, and, you know, all of that, and so I started teaming up with a director of photography named Eric Hurt, and we started making some projects together, and we still collaborate very often,
mm-hmm.
And it's fun because when we went and sold our first movie in Los Angeles, everyone couldn't believe the production value and were able to do things at a lower cost and
yes,
not compromise any quality whatsoever because we have the luxury of living here, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been marvelous being a part of it, even when I was watching from the sidelines, but especially when I was a part of it. But I've seen you. You started out in an office over there in near the television station, 29.
Well, true. Well, actually, Marcello, before that, we started in my dining room.
Oh, well, there you are.
Seven of us around my dining room table, all with our laptops, and my husband would come home and he'd be like, what is happening? I'm like, we are working, we are making something. And he's like, okay. And he actually, my husband's from the computer gaming world,
yes,
and was very familiar with all of the amazing companies that were started out of their garages.
Oh, yes.
You know, very similar to Microsoft and or Apple, you know, etc.
Yes, yes.
So he's used to it. So we had our own version of my company starting in the dining room, and then it's expanded, and now it's become essentially our company because there's so many people that are working there that it's not mine anymore. It's not this little nugget anymore. It's a lot of people, and it's really fun to be able to look back and see how much it's, you know, grown up. It's actually paralleling my son growing up, which is really fun for me, esoterically, you know, fun.
Yes. I don't know where you start counting in terms of age of the company, but how old is Arvold?
Well, the company here, I mean, you have to remember, I did have my own company in,
yes,
Chicago and Los Angeles,
yes,
so I've always been freelance and had my own kind of shingle on the door.
Uh-huh.
But here in Virginia, it's about 5 years old now, and I actually need to count up the months because there's that old saying that, you know, 5 years of business and then you've actually really have a real business. So I'm still waiting to be confirmed that I have a real business.
Oh, I think a few would already confirm that.
I don't know. I think it's good. It's probably good in the mental state that I'm still waiting to see if it's confirmed. That probably keeps me going, you know?
Exactly. And now you have a wonderful office on the downtown mall in Charlottesville, yes?
We do, and actually that's expanding as well because as our, you know, the three things that we do in terms of casting, production, and education really support each other, and I feel like it's incredibly necessary here in town. And we do education in a unique way and want to expose those people who are incredibly serious about their craft, whether they're just starting or whether they're incredibly seasoned. If they're serious about it and very much want to absorb the energy and, you know, experience of others, we have started a program where, for instance, on a show that I've been casting recently, I cast the first season of here in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Actually all along the East Coast, called Turn,
mm-hmm.
which is on AMC now, and one of the lead actors or series regulars named Kevin McNally, who you probably know from,
yes,
the Caribbean movie,
sure,
came came and did a real intensive workshop one afternoon, and I, you know, just invited those that I know are seriously interested in such a thing, and it was phenomenal, and it was, you know, somewhat of a pilot program for the kind of programming we want to have with this education. So it's a little different than one might think originally when you go, oh, education, that's a class on X, Y, and Z. This is a little more of a conversation as well as exposure to some real inside knowledge.
Gotcha. Wow. You know, I do want to talk about TURN and a couple of other more recent projects, but could you give us a little info on World Wars and Big Stone Gap? How are they?
Sure, absolutely. Well, World Wars was incredible. The History Channel called and said, will you come cast this? And there were a few of the roles that were already cast out of New York. And then we had a whole bunch. And the director and the production team were just so exquisitely passionate about the project and really historians themselves. And it's funny because the whole, I mean, Virginia attracts historical subject matter for incredibly obvious reasons, and there is a wonderful kind of feeling one gets when you're standing on the land where something happened, and that's what Virginia is so uniquely able to give these productions, such as you mentioned before, Lincoln, etc. A huge, you know, factor into making that decision of where one's going to shoot. And I think World Wars was the same thing. It was in West Virginia, and so my staff actually had to go be on location for a short period of time, and worked out of a hotel, and it was just amazing. And Michelle Kelly, my associate, who is phenomenal, who's been with me from day one here in Virginia, really, really helmed that project of especially background, and she does background incredibly well. She also does speaking roles really well.
Wow.
And that's the fun thing about casting here in Los Angeles. The people who are interested, the actors who are interested in speaking roles and the actors who are interested in background roles are an incredibly different group of people. There's two very finite groups of people. Here, it's a much more blended group, and it's wonderful because people get exposure and on projects like that, or Big Stone Gap, which was also phenomenal, and in collaboration with another couple of casting directors, my partner Ann Chapman on it, of course, as well as then two other casting directors in New York. We all just, you know, dove in, and Adriana, who is the writer and the director of Big Stone Gap, you know, has exquisite taste and wonderful ideas for who she would like in the cast, and we got an all-star cast, and I'm thrilled. That's one movie I didn't go visit the set, which just, it makes me sad. That's always what I try to do, is go visit the set at least one day, but I was unfortunately casting another project while I was shooting. So, you know, casting's all pre-production. It's so far in advance that once they start shooting, your job's done, really, and I like to go visit and show my face.
And it's a lovely place.
Not always. No, thank you. I want to be everywhere at once. That's biggest fault. I want to do everything everywhere all at the same time.
Well, that's the only way things get done. We of course can't do it all, but if we keep trying, a lot more gets done. And I know what you mean about you know, spending so many years in New York. There was a real separation between the day player, the principal, the extra. But I got a lot of even in New York. I mean, that's how I started out in films. Nobody just walked up and said, "Hey, you, I want to make you a movie star." I started out as an extra, even in soaps, and showed up, did my job. You know, I did exactly what they told me, and before you know it, the assistants that were in charge of extras start pulling you out and saying, okay, I want you to go say this, add that line or whatever, and that's how movies and television started for me as an extra. And then I even had once, you'll love this, once I got on 4 a.m., I think my first movie, King of the Gypsies or something, I was an extra, 4 a.m. on the bus, and the agent in charge stopped me at the front front door and said, everyone pay attention. This is Marcello Rolando, and he's an extra on this movie. And he's the kind of extra you want to be. He's always there when you call him, and he pays attention. And I, you know, at 4 a.m., I wasn't too awake to hear it all. But it's a story I've told many times to students in New York, that people notice what you do. And if you show up, you do your job the best you can, you stay out of trouble, you pay attention, a lot can happen for an extra. And down here in Virginia, as you say, it's even less of a separation. So, you know, the crossover is probably more likely. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it is. I mean, it's funny because especially on a television show where you have the opportunity to be in front of someone visually and be established, sometimes then, you know, in an upcoming episode, all of a sudden there'll be a line written for someone.
Yes.
And that happens more often on television than it does in films. But, you know, when I worked a long time ago when I was in Chicago on a movie, Rudy.
One of my favorites.
Vince Vaughn was an extra in that movie.
Oh, wow.
And it's just funny because I always tell that story to people because, of course, you know, he's like, you know, or in Big Stone Gap, you know, Patrick Wilson or Ashley Judd or Whoopi Goldberg or Jen Elfman, all of the people that are starring in this movie made here in Virginia started somewhere. And it's really fun to be able to, you know, expose someone who's really passionate and doesn't really know how to get involved, and they come to an open call that we have for whatever project we're working on at the time, and, you know, and they get called and they show up on set and they have wardrobe fittings and they are patient and they're long hours and sometimes incredibly crazy weather conditions, and, you know, and we pay great attention and are so appreciative of everyone's patience and willingness to do it. But at the end of the day, it's blissful when you can look at that show and see the back of your arm or, you know, or whatnot.
Yes.
And then the same thing with the speaking roles. I mean, so I came from Los Angeles, as I said, and I didn't know anyone locally, and I only thought I could draw from the LA people that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have a database, and I cover literally the entire East Coast as well as some of the Midwest. And the reach that I have in terms of finding, you know, quality actors for large roles and shows, if it doesn't need to be a star name, which is completely understandable for a lot of reasons, is so incredible. And one of the greatest compliments I've ever received was I was at the governor's mansion for this small gathering, and some of the series regulars for the television show I just finished just kept commenting, thank you so much for bringing in actors that we can work with that are so incredibly seasoned and know their craft and we could play. And it's so rare to do that on a show that's on location. And it was music to my ears.
Wow.
And I'm so proud. So proud of all of the actors that just brought their A game, you know? And that's what it demands.
Absolutely. I wonder, you know, we'll do this again at the end of the show, but now as we approach commercial time, why don't you tell us how you prefer actors get in touch with you? Website?
Thank you. Yes, that's wonderful. So I have a website. It's just the name of the company, www.arvold.com. That's A-R-V as in Victor, O-L-D. The section that says casting is where you go. And in that actors section, you will see that I have a database. And that electronic database is how I receive photos and resumes. I do everything electronically now. It's called Agency Pro for Casting Directors. They will market to actors because they have some wonderful services, but it is never required that anyone purchase their software or purchase a membership or anything. I am 100% fine with a picture and resume in there. That's for free. And that's really it. And then, besides that, we have a Facebook page called Arvold Casting Calls, as well as a Facebook page called Arvold, which is for the company. But the Arvold Casting Calls Facebook page lists all of the notices. If you're not in the database, it lists most of the notices. If you are in the database, you'll actually receive everything via email, a notice as well. And then you submit yourself. And there are many different softwares and delivery systems we use, and it's very much dependent on what our client requires.
Mm-hmm.
So everything from, you know, Breakdown Express to Cast It to Broadcasting Frontier to, you know, other ways of delivering via email or Dropbox or other private ways. We use all sorts of things. So it really behooved actors to be on all of those that I just mentioned, as well as, of course, in our database.
Fantastic. We're going to go to a break, but don't go away, anyone. We'll be back with Erica Arvold, who is, she's a national casting director and turned producer, too, as well. And we want to talk about some of the most recent, at least two of the most recent productions in which she's been involved, but also her future plans. Stay with us. We'll be right back. To the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with my guest today, Erica Arvold, who is a casting director, producer, works film, television. We've been talking about the history of the Arvold Company, its development, but we want to talk now with Erica about a couple of the newer projects. We've mentioned and skirted around Turn, but let's just come right to it. How does it feel to have wrapped the first season of Turn? Now, Turn, for those who don't know, is a television series, thank you, about the Revolutionary War, shot in Virginia, and it's airing on AMC on Sundays at 9 p.m. Just talk about it, Eric. I mean, wow. How did you get it here?
It's incredible. It is truly incredible, and I don't mean just on behalf of the job that we, you know, take painstakingly detailed notes to accomplish, but for Virginia and for the Mid-Atlantic region to have another show that is, you know, so far, knock on wood, doing well in, you know, with the ratings, and it's about the first firing during the Revolutionary War, which really has, it's such fertile ground for story. And, you know, as a casting director, I read every episode, of course, and, you know, figure out what characters I'm going to be looking for and casting. And it was funny because I would flip through the script and literally forget to highlight the characters I was supposed to be casting because I was so overwhelmed
Wow.
with the story that I would get to the end and then I'd go, oh, whoops, hold on, I've got to read it again for my job because I was so enjoying it. And I think that Craig Blerstein, who is created, well, wrote the show based on Alexander Rose's book, and of course Barry Josephson is the executive producer, he really, they've created such an incredible show. And then Larry Rappaport, who's a producer who I have had the pleasure of working for on a lot of Virginia-based productions, Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, the pilot of Turn, and now the first season of Turn. Mm. He has really brought so much to the table in terms of Virginia production. It's amazing. But the painstaking detail about Turn is just, it's fascinating because we have to have, first of all, the right body type, meaning very thin for the most part, because
yes,
it is Revolutionary War and food was scarce and cabbage, you know, would
sure
get infested with maggots and
yes
then there would be nothing to eat for these farmers. And the other, to have a certain amount of long hair.
Long hair, yes,
the
but no facial
War
hair.
Is clean, well, no, clean shaven for Revolutionary War, but the Civil War, like Turn and, the Civil War, excuse me, like Lincoln and
yes
Lincoln, that was a lot of facial hair.
Yes.
And then we went back to the Revolutionary War, and now it's clean shaven. So I seem to know how quickly every gentleman's facial hair grows.
Yes.
I have intimate knowledge of the rate of growth, but more seriously, you know, sometimes there would be a character that, whether they were speaking or non-speaking, it didn't matter, but they would have to, you know how to, let's just say, slaughter a pig. I'm giving that for an example.
Oh,
that
God
wasn't really exactly a case. But and we literally have to go and figure out who knows how to properly slaughter a pig for
wow
the feet. And an episode that just aired, as a matter of fact, we found someone that there was a spinning wheel, and they had to really do that, and there was another person sewing, and they had to know how to sew.
Sure.
So all these life skills that people have as their actors, sometimes they're like, oh, we don't have any skills, we don't
yeah
have, you know, we don't have 4 years of training, of class, of acting. It's like sometimes you go, no, but you know what, you know how to sew, and you know how to sew in this specific way, and this is what we need. It's been really fun, but we do so much research, and, you know, down to ethnicities, if there are African Americans in the show, if there are roles for African American, we figure out, you know, okay, well, it's the Revolutionary War, so, you know, what type of look are we looking for, as well as variation of skin color, and people that work in the field were a different tone of skin than people that were house slaves.
Yes.
And it is just incredibly, I'm getting such a history lesson by working on all these period pieces,
wow.
And
yes,
that's how I learn. It's just, it's incredible. But we take great pride in the detail. And of course, we don't want white, straight, bleached teeth like that are very popular in Crest commercials today.
Yes.
We want, you know, real teeth that are crooked or, you know, have cheese stains on them or whatnot. And so all of these things, no plastic surgery, please. No colored hair. Do you know what I mean? Dyed hair. Everything is just natural and long. And so, but we've got a lot of dancers, a lot of, you know, people with all sorts of, we had to, very physically demanding roles and for speaking parts as well. But, you know, and that's the fun of, you know, I was talking about visiting sets and how I didn't get to go visit this one feature film set for Big Fucking Gap, which really just, you know, is like a knife in my heart because I want to see what that work, you know, paid off to be, essentially. Mm-hmm. But Turn is the opposite for me because I can go anytime. Our office is right there. And so one day I was casting and the stunt coordinator came over and said, look, we really need this actor to do this scene. I was like, I know, that's an incredibly difficult scene. Is that a stunt player? And we're going to have a double, but we're going to figure this out, but they need to be comfortable doing X, Y, and Z. He's like, hold on, I have the guys here. They're practicing next door. Come see it. And I got to actually go watch the rehearsal of what the fight was going to be, so it actually informed my casting. So it's this much more intimate relationship with all of the departments, frankly, when one is on a series. And I missed that. I did a couple series in Chicago as well as in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And I missed it, and I didn't realize how much I missed it until this series was here. So when I say having accomplished the first season was incredible, it's on so many different levels, you know.
Wow, that's fabulous. I got so busy with radio, I couldn't even audition, but now I'm really upset that I didn't. But, well,
let's hope it comes back for season two.
That's right.
You never know, but we'll cross our fingers.
Exactly. We can all be selfish.
Yes.
Besides, it's a great work. It really is great work, and it's certainly a fantastic thing for Virginia. You know, I just, by the way, the other day, I had as a guest the director of sales and marketing for the, let me get it right now, the Charlottesville Albemarle County Convention and Visitors Bureau, and I told her all about you, and she said, oh, that's a tremendous draw for Virginia. What an asset. Thank you for telling me that. And so you're going to be out there as part of the marketing of bringing people to Virginia to visit the Commonwealth. So,
fantastic.
You know,
fantastic. That's what I hope. I mean, it's funny because I thought when I lived here I'd have to commute back and forth to Los Angeles, and thankfully, because the incentives have been passed, et cetera, there are more and more productions coming here. And I think Virginia does have, I mean, the Mid-Atlantic has an amazing assortment of crew and talented people, so that's not an issue. And then Virginia has the added benefit of being the real deal, as in you walk the land that those characters in history have walked. And so between those things, I can tell you there is a groundswell. I think Turn, in my humble opinion, Turn is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah,
there is so much more lined up to come, and opportunity is incredible. And I just, you know, I really keep saying, I think we're the next Atlanta, which has seen a surge of production.
Sure.
And I really, you know, we've just got to keep it up. We've got to keep up all of the fine work that we're doing and just continue raising the bar of filmmaking here, and I think we'll just reap the benefits in the next 5 years.
Fantastic. Well, speaking of the immediate future, not the next 5 years yet, maybe, but the immediate future first, tell us about what I think is your latest project, Chesapeake.
Ah, Chesapeake, yes.
Yes.
This is for certain a passion project. I think it's it's really, really my passion right now, and it's a collaboration once again with writer-director Eric Hirt, and it's about a waterman in the Chesapeake Bay who rescues a boy and a woman from drowning in the bay, and his life is changed because of it.
Mm.
And the story is a beautiful drama, very much of a redemptive tale, and the way Eric Hirt writes it, and of course he's a cinematographer by trade, the way he envisions it is incredibly beautiful, with a lot of visual metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So that of an underwater, you know, a blue crab that is, you know, when you have soft crabs, it's because you've come out of your shell, and then there's a very short period of time until your next shell hardens, and you have the crab has a specific amount of time to actually escape the shell that it's outgrown as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that metaphor very much is parallel to our main character, who comes out of a shell, essentially. And so using those visuals, as well as underwater photography and a lot of photography on the bay itself,
wow,
is really going to celebrate the message of the story, and I'm so excited about it. And we remain in development. We are raising funds. We are, you know, setting everything in place to get ready to shoot, and, you know, just have the gas pedal to the floor as
yes,
far as getting a movie together. Independent, small film, Virginia-based, Virginia-made, definitely very Chesapeake Bay-oriented. So we are Virginia filmmakers, of course, but we will also be shooting in Maryland,
mm-hmm,
and all around the Chesapeake Bay. And, you know, the watershed, the Chesapeake watershed itself, is a very large area and encompasses 17 million people. So I think everyone really hopefully knows about the Chesapeake Bay,
mm-hmm,
and hopefully understands its challenges right now. And this movie is truly meant to plant that seed. If people don't know about it yet, they can see a wonderful fictional drama, dramatic story. And,
yes,
and then realize, wow, this Chesapeake Bay is right here. At least that's what happened to me. I didn't know about it until, mm-hmm, I read this script and Eric had been telling me about it, and I went out there and I fell madly in love with it.
Wow. Okay, let's talk now about the distant future, or at least the next 5 years. You count 5 years as your the age of our old company at this point. What do you think is going to happen in the next 5 years? I mean, you're just going gangbusters here, and it keeps getting better. What are your hopes, your dreams, your goals?
I just want to keep expanding. I want there to be more production here. Very selfishly, my family's here. I would like to be here. I don't want to keep, you know, go to Los Angeles, although I love going in my old house there, and I go quite a bit, frankly, mm-hmm, to LA and New York. But as far as living and working here, that's certainly what I prefer. And with our company, the expansion of, you know, the education realm that I was mentioning, as well as the production, you know, I like making movies that make a difference. Like Chesapeake is really something that is a fictional film. It's definitely there for entertainment, but I think it really does make people aware and helps to better the planet, honestly. And it sounds very Mary Poppins of me, but that's my passion. And I love character-driven stories, and I think that comes from my background, certainly in casting, in mm-hmm, that I just need to, you know, jump to that main character's shoes and feel and empathize and cry and laugh. And that's what I like about movies. It's that sort of, you know, relationship and escapism for me with the characters that's so paramount. And if these movies and television shows keep coming here and I keep getting my hands on them,
yes,
as a producer, that's what I want to do.
Exactly.
I want to do more of them.
No, that's, you know, that is so, it's just so incredible. It's a dream come true. I mean, I know you've done all of this before, Virginia, but and you know, all those, even when I was in New York living and working, when I needed a break from the city, I would actually hop a train or rent a car, and I would come to Virginia. I would come to Central, because I'd lived in Virginia prior to going to New York, and I would drive around to all the known historical sites we have here, you know, Monticello, Montpelier, Ashland, etc. But I would would also drive around in the back roads and find places that I'd only maybe heard of slightly or not at all, and whip out the camera, and it's just a beautiful state. It's full of history, and now that if it can become one of the major hubs for cinema and television, I mean, I love living here anyway, but it's a whole added stream of ripples of excitement that and the state is reaching out for that, don't you think? I mean, your experience, they...
Oh, absolutely. And there is, I mean, I can tell you that more key crew members are moving to Virginia because they see what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And it's actually wonderful because it would be great for our state to have a number of crews deep. So let's just say in an ideal world, and that's what I do wish for the next, you know, 5 years, mm-hmm. is that we can have a production equivalent to Lincoln here, have a series equivalent to Turn here, and have, you know, a number of independent films here that, you know, if it could be two or three crews deep, if you know what I mean,
yes. Oh, yes.
That would be incredible. And I think people are anticipating that, and I think people are already kind of setting up shop here,
yes.
and moving here and providing services here. And that doesn't mean anyone that lives here is going to be outed. I think there's going to be so much work that everyone here will be working, and more people will be working. You know?
Yes, yes.
So,
you know, as we sort of end this, I could go on forever with you. You know that. It's so wonderful. But let's touch on our last collaboration, shall we call it? Lincoln, as we end the show, tell me, how did you feel? There's just so many levels which I cannot be, I can't even say thanks enough for your part and my being a part of that. It was just an incredible experience of being in the same room and watching Steven Spielberg direct Tommy Lee Jones and Sally Field. But you tell me from your point of view. This must have been, it was obviously a huge accomplishment, but tell us about, because I know your passion and what thrills you about movies. Address it or to Lincoln for a couple of minutes for us.
Yes, yes. Well, my you know, emotional state about that movie is twofold. One, such huge amounts of pride in not only being able to do a project at that level, because that is what the realm of the level of projects I was working in Los Angeles.
Sure.
And I was missing a little bit of that when I first moved here, especially not working at all. But, you know, I love working on small projects. Every commercial, every one-day job I get, I love equally as much as the big fancy movies. So that, I like the diversity of it and the whole spectrum of it. But I was not getting a balanced spectrum because I hadn't yet known that Lincoln was coming. So when Lincoln came, I was, as a professional, so happy to play with the big boys again,
yes.
to do my job. Everyone knew the lingo. Everyone knew everything. And I absolutely was just in my element. That's the best way to say it. And I was in my element. My wings were spread, and I could fly as high as I wanted. And I loved that about it. As a creative person, that was so thrilling. But the other one, or not but, and, the other aspect was, I have kind of this crazy nurturing personality, which is probably why I'm a casting director in the first place. And I just felt like everyone who got a role, yourself included, my heart was so big with happiness for everyone that got a role and got to have that experience and see how it can really be done, you know, and as well as lend your own sublime talent to a production that made it better. So it was, you know, a give and take from everybody, regardless of size of the role or the experience that anyone had. It just really was one of those collaborative things that I am just incredibly, incredibly grateful on all sorts of levels that it came here and that the Virginia Film Office got it here. I mean, Rita McClenny and, you know, and Andy Edmonds are just incredible. Incredible.
Fantastic. Well, I certainly share your joy of it. It was, as you say, when you work with the big boys, they all know what they're doing, and yet at the same time, we were all important. Everybody in that in the State House, you know, 100 actors, every detail, all the specifics. There just was nothing overlooked or too small to be attended to. It was fabulous in every level and every detail.
And that's the craft of filmmaking, where everyone is a link in a chain. You cannot make a film without collaboration in every piece in there, and especially people. Filmmaking is a collaborative people process, and that's what I think is just so beautiful about it. And I'm an artist, as you know, as well.
Yes.
And I'll go solo and paint my pictures, but I really thrive off of the collaboration of filmmaking, and I'm so lucky to be able to do it here.
Fantastic. I can't think of a better ending note than that. This has been Erica Arvold of Arvold Company in Centwell, up and down the East Coast.
It's just called Arvold, yes. Arvold, yeah. Period. That's it.
Arvold, that's it. Arvold, I love it. If you don't live in Virginia, you want to really consider this as a reason to move here. And if you love film and love TV, regardless of how you're, you know, whether you're production end or in front of, behind the camera, sound, lights, whatever, you need to find Arvold on the internet and introduce yourself to the team. Erica, I can't thank you enough.
The team is key. I just have to do a shout out. My office is amazing. You guys, I love you all.
Fantastic. Thank you, Erica. And all the best to all of us because of you, as well as the best to you as well. All right?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on, Marcella. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Welcome, everyone, back to The Reasonable Voice. Today on our panel, we have Michelle Opperman, Bernard Hankins, Marcella Rolando, and Daniel L. Garner. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of the creative mind. Also, when we talk about creativity, we limit to the sphere of arts, like painting and dancing. But creativity is a way of life, of which very much has a gigantic impact on everything from society to business. And Mr. Hankins, how do you think that the arts and business can coalesce to the benefit of all of us?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I was actually thinking about that on the way over. And there's always this marriage kind of friction between art and business in our culture.
Yeah.
And I think what it is that the business people, I think they see creative people and it's like, oh, you guys are so flaky and you're just going to want to create all day and you just have endless ideas and you're never going to do anything. And their response is, you need to get organized, you need to get structured, you need to get some control about yourself. And what I'm saying is like, no, you guys are the structure.
Mm-hmm.
The business people are the structure. You bring that to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And if the creative people saw opportunities in which their art would be contained and their ideas would be contained, they would say, oh, here's a goal. Here's a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something to work towards that I know is going to reap something and is going to benefit everybody. They would then put themselves in that container. But creative people are not organized by default. That's why they don't do a good job of running organizations. Not all creative people, but in general, the creative mind wants to create, and that's what they're good at doing. But the problem is, since the economy is not there to support them, they end off on the side trying to create and seeming to go nowhere, but it's not because they don't have drive or motivation. It's because they're saying, we need support. We need help. We have the ideas, but the business people are like, well, we want to see evidence first before we support. And the creative people are like, you guys got a lot of money. Like, just put some in here first and let us create. And then, you know, and there's going to be, it's like business people. They say you're going to fail in business, but it's not okay to fail in creativity for some reason.
Well, I don't know. To me, I mean, that's an excellent point. And why, since all business is based on someone's idea, someone's invention, someone's creation, someone trying to figure out a puzzle and putting it together, that's what artists do all the time. So when we say creative persons, we're not just talking about artists, of course, but you know, artists have to do that. Writers, poets, composers, actors, they all have to, a painter, you know, if there's an idea in their head that they then can put on a flat surface, a canvas or something. So if you channel that, as you say, Bernard, if the two disciplines, which are really cannot possibly be as successful separate from one another as they could be together. It would seem to me it's not just a win-win. That's too casual a way to put it. It's a necessity. It's a joint venture that needs to happen. So what do we do about that?
Quick follow. I mean, to me, I'm always amazed that I see people who, like, I just wish we had some ideas, some creativity.
Yeah.
I'm like, you have artists over here spewing, overflowing with ideas, and they're waiting to be contained in some environment.
And they look at things differently than you do, which is exactly what you need. I wonder why it hasn't occurred to the business community to, I mean, you go to advertising companies for creative ideas to promote your product. I don't know.
I think people are coming around. You see things like the Doritos contest.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
asking people to make commercials. Like, they got it now. Like, oh, we've got all this free labor and free ideas, and we can just pay them if the product is good.
So people sounds like an artist.
Sounds like people are catching on that the creativity is not within the four walls of our marketing firm, but it's actually out there where the people are.
I think a lot of people associate creativity with fun, and fun equals flaky. And also, business person says, well, I'm not going to work, and you get to have all the fun. You're going to work, too, because creativity equals entertainment, and art equals pastime. So if you're talking about wanting to concentrate on the art, you're saying, I want to play all day in their mind, so they don't want to support that, because they want you to work and suffer, too. I think to that, that's part of it. I think, too, ironically, like you were saying, Bernard, when you want to organize environments, so much, Daniel Goldman has this great new book called Focus, where he talks about how a lot of creativity is a consequence of being in these kind of chaotic environments, that then you look for patterns, instructions, you bring them together and create something new out of it. In the very act of creating an organized environment so that that you then put the creative person in, you thus rob them of really a lot of what makes them creative. And so you, like the businessman is like, okay, well, once you get organized, then you can be creative. Well, then you're not creative, so they say, well, I gave you a chance and you weren't creative, so I'm never going to give artists money again. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think, too, lastly, because of the internet, because of so much information, what's starting to happen is a lot more people are starting to be creative, because it's, you have to start figuring out how to find patterns and how to comprehend all the information, unless you just become apathetic to it all. So then you do have these Doritos contests. You have companies like Google. You have a lot of entrepreneurship is arising up. Now, I'm still afraid that a lot of this entrepreneurial activity that's occurring is a reaction against a bad job market versus a transformation in our way of thinking, which is what we need. We need an essential transformation, not just a reactionary change, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
Well, I think another thing that's made me think about is how like, I was watching some, like, tutorials on sales today, and I think, like, it's interesting because the salesman or the businessman, he's creative, too, you know. But you know what's the big difference between the artist and the businessman is motivation. It's, like, what is the goal here? And I think what I saw a lot in this, like, because it's essentially like acting when you are doing sales. It's an act. And you are really, you know, you are going to be persistent, and you are going to put on a show and tell a story. And that sounds so similar to an actor. Mm-hmm. That's an artist. That's a performer. And but I think what's so interesting is that there's this very market-minded, like the businessman is going to essentially like repeat his, you know, his pyramid, you know, of closing until it works. It's like never leave with a no.
Yeah.
The artist, I think, on the other hand, is more interested in, you know, creating, because this is the thing, you know, salesperson walks in, like something that, you know, people who teach on sales will say is they just want to get rid of you, okay? But like when somebody's playing music, you don't want them to, you don't want to get rid of them, like unless you like hate music, but who hates music? Everybody loves music. You know, everybody loves like beautiful things. Everybody loves to see a good movie. You know, everybody loves to see a beautiful performance, a dance. And it's, so it's like you, that's something that you don't want to say no to. So it's interesting because they both like offer something, like the businessman is going to be persistent, the artist is going to make things that people actually want, you know, like a store owner doesn't want people coming in and asking them, do you want to buy this or that, you know, so it's like this interesting, they could actually work really well, you know, together. The other thing I was going to say is that both the businessman and the artist are disciplined. You know, the businessman is disciplined and he has a lot of hard work to do, but the artist has a lot of hard work to do, and I think that the mark of a good artist is one who persists and works on their trade every day, no matter what. So I think there's, you know, what I wanted to say mainly is that they're both creative, they're both disciplined, and I think It's a sad thing to think of that they're so far apart. But it's motivation, ultimately, that usually is their difference.
Mm-hmm. So me, Michelle, and Daniel, we have a company called Cypher. And so what Cypher does is we try to bring all of these elements together. So, for instance, we did something called pitchcraft. I'm glad Michelle said acting. So we took myself as a poet, mm-hmm. an actress, and a comedian, and an entrepreneur, and we had all of them have 10 minutes each to talk about how do I captivate an audience. Mm-hmm. Because if you're giving a pitch to a guy who you want money from, and you're just giving him the facts, sure, he wants to hear that because he wants to know how am I going to make my money back. Mm-hmm. But if I come in there and I have the facts and I can say something about your granddaughter, and now I'm hitting that emotional note, and he's like, oh, makes me think of my granddaughter. Mm-hmm. I'm capturing both parts of you. Mm-hmm. So I have much more of a likelihood of sealing the deal mm-hmm. because I'm communicating with the full human being. So we're trying to do things like that. And we also had an event recently at a Tom Tom Festival where we took an actress, a designer, and a doctor, and we had them all talk about empathy. Mm-hmm. And so, because to me, it was interesting to hear the doctor. She was saying, oh, people don't know, we role play all the time. Mm-hmm. We have to sit down with our doctor friends, and we have to go through a script over and over and over. We have to rehearse these lines. We have to talk to a patient this way. We have to get up on stage, and we have to rehearse in front of an auditorium full of our peers. How empathetic did I appear to that, you know, that patient? So to me, it's extremely important for all of these things to come together because you're dealing with whole human beings. You're mm-hmm. not just talking to the business part of Marcello. If I'm trying mm-hmm. to sell you a vacuum, what do? I use an emotional appeal. Mm-hmm. Don't you like coming home to a clean house?
Yes.
Don't you like coming home and orderly
and fresh smelling?
You know, right. I don't start saying, well, this picks up, you know, the dirt at 5, you know, this velocity rate. That doesn't appeal to you. I talk to the part of you that I know wants to go,
That's true. And, you know, and another thing, all of you are making me think of years ago when I first went to New York, everything was fine. Then it wasn't fine. I didn't know what to do. I came back to Maryland and found the richest actor I knew. He had a big house, beautiful home, a Mercedes and a Porsche. And I said, David, what do you do for a living? He says, well, I sell real estate, and I'd love to have you as one of my real estate people. He was the broker. And I go to the school, you know, the class. I attend a math tutor because what do I know about math? And I end up back in the office. You know, now I'm a real estate agent, and all the real estate sales people are telling me, well, you know it's going to be 6 months before you sell a house. So I go right into Manager David's office and I say, what on earth am I going to do? You said I was going to make a lot of money so I can go back to New York and be an actor. And David said, don't listen to those salespeople. You are an actor. And do you know what actors do that salespeople don't? They listen. I had directed David in a show, and he remembered that, my saying that. And I say it to actors all the time. The most important thing about acting is listening. So I think the creative person does bring emotional empathy, but they also bring the art of listening to what the customer, the client, the patient wants and needs. An audience, because they are our audience. We want to know what they need. What's going to make them laugh? What's going to make them cry? What's going to make them applaud? What's going to make them go out and talk about it and bring their friends back? Mm-hmm. That's something the artist brings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, it's strange with artists. We either look at them as impractical or deities. I mean, they're in Hollywood or they're no one.
Yeah.
We're very extreme in our thinking, which is very strange because it is not so much artists we care about, but celebrities, which is, I think, an important distinction. We think because we go to the movies, we care about the arts. No, we care about celebrities, and we care about being entertained. I think a Renaissance culture is one in which the arts is very much integrated into the human experience versus the I'm off of work and I don't want to think about it anymore experience. I think, too, often when people hear artists, they think guy with guitar at open mic. Their scope of art is very limited. And also, then, you see, the thing about a lot of people, not everyone who plays a guitar, I'm not saying it's a guitar, is not a bad thing at all, but it's something that, is kind of, it's something that can be more of a pastime that people like listening to guitars. It has that sort of appeal of sitting on the lawn next to a tree and the girl with blonde hair comes up as you play the guitar. That's fine, but when that's your scope of what an artist is, then it doesn't go into this kind of entire way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It also makes art a means to an end rather than an end of itself, because it's like, oh, people are looking at me and applauding versus this was an excellent performance. Now, that said, there are extraordinary guitarists who do extraordinary work. work. And like whether there are people who play piano and do acting and paint just so they can tell people they do these things. But if that is what we're so used to, it's hard for us to think of creativity as essential. And I think the other thing I'm a little worried about in our current kind of change in the direction of entrepreneurship, and there is some talk about creativity, is that then people are starting to go, well, let's add some creative people on our panel so we can have diversity. Mm-hmm. Where then it's just matching a quota in the same way we say, oh, we need to have a woman, an Asian, an African-American on our panel or our business so that we can then kind of say we've got our quota. Well, if that's still our way of thinking, then creativity is just going to be that thing we add so we can say we've added it versus this entire mode in which we engage with the world and thus make it a new and more beautiful place.
Which is the reason that Google has this new product called Helpouts, where you can create a teaching, a seminar, and you can charge per hour, per minute, and people find you, and they sign up, and then they do it online through your laptop. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing one which is public speaking from the perspective of a spoken word poet.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that's kind of the heart of what I'm getting at, is because I get on the stage all the time, and I feel very comfortable. You put me in a social situation, no, I don't like to talk to people, but for whatever reason, I get on the stage, and I come alive, I'm transformed, and I know there's people who may be very good at business and pitching, but then you put them on stage, and they're, like, terrified. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't they come to me, who does it naturally, to get help, or even have me do it for you? Mm-hmm. You know, why? If you don't like pitching your product, fine, get an actor, get a performer to do it. Who cares as long as you seal the deal? Mm-hmm. The guy's not going to be like, well, you didn't pitch the product yourself. Did the idea come across clearly? Is it going to make money? That is the end goal. So why is it that we're, like, resisting one another? And I don't think the artists, well, the artists do have, they resist business in certain ways, too. Like, oh, I don't want to sell out. I don't want to be a part of commercial stuff ever. But I think the artist is probably a little more willing than the business person to come over, because the artist is like, hey, I have these gifts to give. I really want to do something with them. The business guy is more like, I haven't seen that proven yet, so I don't really want to take a risk on it. Where the artist is usually about taking risks all the time, because they're always trying to discover and explore and experiment.
That reminds me with it's a funny thing, it isn't, but when the recession hit us and everyone was talking about the losing of jobs and whatever, I had a conversation with my friend of 30 years, and we realized, we didn't even think about it until we talked, that the reason it's not hitting us as much is because we've always been in the arts. It's never been 9 to 5. We were always, while you were doing the show, or in his case, the church music, you were working toward the next job, because when this job was over, and it was a shorter period of time than 30 years of 9 to 5, you had to, you know, get out there and get the next job. So I guess we were sort of used to this kind of uncertainty, not that I'm wishing it on anyone, including myself, but I do think a marriage, I do think we have, the time has come for America to accept a transformation, not just in what we're talking about in this panel, but in other panels that we've discussed. It's time to look, because it is possible. I really do think this, and I'm not saying this because I want it to happen or that because it's the worst thing that could happen. It is possible, with the rate at which we are using the rainforest and energy resources and electricity, etc., that we may find ourselves back in a time of my grandmama, and although my grandmama had a nice car, but I mean needing the horsepower, literally horsepower, and lamps and candles, because it's not. We tend to think, you know, the light switch, you click it on, you turn on the AC, and it's always there. Yeah. That isn't even the case in this country. But when we don't stop to think about it, everyone's draining what Mother Earth has to give. And if it one day doesn't have any more to give, then are we just, that's it? We just sit around and go, where's my air conditioner? I mean, we have to be willing to face that there's a transformation coming. It can be our choice. We can go after climate change. We can rethink. Or it can be nature's choice. But I think we need to... How do we get on that? Michelle. It's Michelle's fault.
It's my fault. It's always my fault.
Yeah.
I think that makes... That's really interesting. It makes me think about how, like, you know, before, if you had a horse, that was, like, a really valuable
thing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It was a really valuable thing.
A horse thief would get hanged.
Yeah. And, I mean, now it's, like, it's interesting today how we value money more than things that are valuable. You know what I mean? It's, like, we forget that, like, there are things that innately have a value. Mm-hmm. But because we've become so, like... almost beyond, you know, the simple things, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost as if it doesn't necessarily matter that you can do this thing, because if you're not able to make it a big thing, mm-hmm. and you know, be able to make it profitable to, you know, in a way that's noticeable, I guess, then it's like it doesn't matter. But it does have value.
Yeah.
It still has value. And heck, if we are, you know, back to horsepower, literally, it would have one of the most values of all. It's like having, like, hand skills. And, you know, I mean, I think everything you can do is valuable, but it just, and can be used positively. But I think there's, we somehow have, like, we forget to justify things and see things as valuable in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And we often use, like the guy, we talk a lot about the economy, but, like, the economy sometimes it infiltrates our thoughts about, you know, like ourselves. Like, you know, if somebody gets an education at the public library, it can be looked at as not a real education versus somebody who went to Columbia. And there's reasons for that, and Columbia is a great school. But, you know, it's interesting how we validate things. And it's almost like we've abstracted things and we're kind of stuck there, and that can be to our own detriment. But anyways, Bernard, you're
going. Last thing before we go, I think I can't remember exactly how Daniel said, but I thought it was a great quote he came up with, which is, you know, the artist is kind of punished for not being scientific, but yet the scientist is praised for being creative.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, but you, like, you know, would you get to tie together what you guys are saying? You know, when you see GE and their logo as a light bulb, like, there's a sense that, like, oh, yeah, innovation, creativity, thinking outside of the box is something to be praised when it has an end goal of making a light bulb. Or, you know, when the presidents talk about, oh, we need more innovation, it's always scientific-related only.
Yes.
If we can get some new piece of medical technology, some kind of product out of it, then it's creative. But other types of creativity, well, that's like Daniel said, that's for when you're doing an open mic and you want to sit in the field and play, you know, the guitar. But yeah, if anybody's interested, you know, Cypher, Cypher, cypherideas.com, you can find out about Pitchcraft and other things we're doing. And if you want to check out Bernard Hankins on Google Helpouts, you can look me up.
Yes.
Shameless self-promotion, and it's great and worthy, and we should,
it.
Yes. And Tom, Bernard was very much involved, as was Daniel, with Tom Founders Festival here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it was a great success. And there was all the rippling effects of trying and doing with this creative mixer they put together. I was there. I mean, they had business people, community people, artistic people. Who else am I missing? We're all in the same room, and when they were asked, because Bernard forced us to talk to one another, when we were asked how to what we thought was needed to accomplish this, that, and the other thing for the society, both in the city level, the county, and the state, everybody was saying the same thing, even though they may have said it a little differently. It all was the same thing, and it was about that unity. It just was a great experience. So there it is.
Well, I think that was a fantastic discussion, and I think a creative society is a society that can see the value in the world around it, them, and the people around it, in the people around them. So hopefully we can get a little more creativity in our world so that we can have a little more sense of what really truly matters.
Bravo.
It's been a discussion of The Reasonable Voice. Thank you for tuning in, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.